Hello, everyone. I'm excited to welcome you at Dev Propulsion Labs, our podcast about the business of developer tools. My name is Victoria Melnikova, and I am the head of new business at Evil Martians. I'm very excited to introduce today's guest. Today, we have Zana Rocha, founder and CEO of Resend, email API for developers. Hi, Zana.
Hello. Hi. Hey, everyone.
How are you today?
Pretty good. Yeah, really excited to chat with you. I know we've been chatting for a while, so it's happening. So I'm happy to be here.
I'm very excited to have this conversation with you for many reasons. And I will start with a couple of personal reasons.
Nice.
So if people who know me close, they know that I'm obsessed with Brazil.
Nice.
And in my LinkedIn bio, it says a Russian Ipanema girl, because in university, I studied Brazilian Portuguese. Wow. And I lived in Rio for a bit.
Wow.
So I'm very attached. And I'm curious about your background. So can you tell me, how was it growing up in Brazil? And how do you get into coding in Brazil?
Yeah, I'm originally from a city called Curitiba in the south, which is known for having more cold people. There's a lot of folks that migrated from Italy and Poland. So we're more like introverts. So growing up, I was an introvert. And I remember my dad was really big into learning English and telling how important that was. And my grandpa was also very excited about computers when this was becoming a thing. So I would say those two things, just learning English when I was around 10. And of course, growing up in other countries, we're so influenced by American culture overall. So listening to music in English or playing video games in English, watching movies and all that. And then those two things were just so crucial. When I look back and think what are the two pillar things that put me in a good situation to be where I am right now? Without those two things, I wouldn't be here. So I started to play games any other kid on my computer and got really excited about that. But yeah, I kept just climbing the map. So I was born in Curitiba, then I lived in Rio for 6 or 7 years, which is just incredible, right? In the beginning, I used to hate Rio, actually, because the culture was so different from mine that I had a hard time adjusting, but now I really appreciate it. And then lived in Recife on the Northeast, and then went to LA and SF. But we'll go through that journey together. But yeah, it's been really cool to experience those different cultures. And at every point, I feel like you're grabbing a little bit of that culture to yourself. So now I feel like I'm from everywhere.
Do you feel like you're more extroverted now? Or
yeah,
you have to be?
Yeah, sometimes, right? I feel like as a founder, I truly believe I have to spend time working on my founder brand along with the company brand. So I truly believe that people buy from people, not from companies. I was just having breakfast with Roy from Cluely, So it doesn't matter if you're a pro or against him, but it's undeniable that he has a founder persona, just like Guillermo and so many other founders that we know within DevTools and so on. So I care a lot about that. And sometimes I have to put on that extrovert clothing, which is not something I'm used to. I prefer to be on my computer just coding and yeah.
That's so interesting. So as I was researching you and Resend for the episode, I of course came across your handbook. Yes. And your handbook is kind of so powerful and so concise, and it's in the system of it, there is so much strength. And even when you talk about the brand of Resend, you have three adjectives that describe Resend. I'm not going to quote them, but when we talk about your personal brand, can you also boil it down to three adjectives?
Wow, that's really hard. Because, yeah, I feel like I try not to overthink my personal brand as much, or have oh, here's my full strategy. I just try to be myself because that's how I feel like people are drawn to folks that are, they try not to impersonate or be someone else. So I just try to be as organic as possible. But yeah, I just like nerding about dev tools and developer experience. That's a subject I like a lot. I love design as well. So when you combine those things and with the handbook, I'm glad you call it out because I remember when I first had the idea to write that handbook, I'm like, yeah, this is not something new. Like there are many companies that have handbooks that are publicly available. But we are very early on in the journey of Reason. We were still like a year and a half and it was a team of like 10 people. So why do you need a handbook when you haven't found PMF? You have like 10 people, like you can share the culture just by itself, right? But I knew that for us to scale, we would need that. So it took us months to get to that initial version of like 30-something articles. And I remember midway through that process, I was like, wow, this was such a mistake. Like, it's just taking so long. Like, because it's hard. Like, engineers don't want to write things down. And it's hard to compile. It's easy to write something very long. Writing something that feels simple, objective, that's hard. It takes a lot of editing on top of the writing. But how that thing played out was like, now I'm so grateful because people that sometimes don't know us or candidates that are interviewing, they reference the handbook and they self-select as well. And that helps with customers too. Customers self-select. They feel like, oh, wow, these guys care about quality. They care about excellence. Okay. I care about that too. I feel like we're living in a world where we associate ourselves with brands that we aspire to. So if you care about quality, you're probably going to be using Linear and Notion and Raycast, right? So that's how we try to position the brand as well.
That's very interesting. How big is your team now?
Almost 30, around 30 people. Yeah.
What are the functions that you rely on heavily today? What is the most... because you're now Series A, you're growing,
yes.
Right?
And yes.
What are some functions that are kind of new to you and you rely on heavily today?
I think for us, hiring engineers and designers came out naturally. But then, and generalists, that was something we will always be looking for. But then we started to notice like, oh, we actually need support people. And I've worked with support people in the past, but like identifying what greatness looks like in support people, that's a different skill. Now we're hiring for data scientists to handle all of our anti-abuse systems because email is full with bad actors, right? So now we are just having to learn like, who are these people? What do they care? Like, why would someone, you know, sit all day doing SQL queries? Like, that doesn't come natural for us. So you just have to like, arm yourself with like folks that you can rely and ask questions and then meet people. Like we learn throughout the hiring process. So we open a role as we interview, like for this one in particular, we open as a data analyst. And now we're like, maybe it's not really a data analyst that we're looking. Maybe it's a data scientist and there are differences between them. So it's one of the challenges of being a founder. You're hiring for roles that you've never worked at. We just hired a chief of staff. So that was another one. Like, what does that mean? You know, like how do we keep that person happy and motivated? What are their values? How does that match our values? So everyone at Reason has engineer on their job title, even today. Like all the supporting folks are customer success engineers. All the designers are design engineers. So that engineering mindset is something we try to foster. But as we grow, you know, there are so many challenges to scale a company.
Let's stay here for a second. You mentioned the security aspect. And just recently, I think early October, right, you announced that you're investing $3 million into the security of email, basically. Was this decision kind of like a pressure from the market that you felt? Because email is so crowded with, I don't know, spam and phishing and all kinds of things. Or was it just kind of like part of an excellent developer experience?
That's something I started to realize because when you think about developer experience, you might just look into the interface that developers are handling. So you might think only about the SDK or the design of the API and the endpoints and how does that interact with the rest or the docs. So your mind goes to those places. And for us, a key insight when we started Recent was that Recent was a developer tool. And as we went by, we're like, oh no, whenever we had a downtime, people will like freak out. And we realized like, oh no, maybe we're not a dev tools. Maybe we are an infrastructure company. And the way you operate for those two things are very differently. I think it was that realization that we have as we're building. And for me, what developer experience means started to become something much broader. So it's not only the surface layer that developers interacting, but you know, I can have the most beautiful website in the world, the most beautiful SDK, so ergonomic with auto pagination when you're listing things. But if the app is down, it's all for nothing, right? Same with security. I can have the most beautiful, the most amazing product, but if folks are struggling with that and we're leaking data or whatever, then it's not a good experience. And it also comes down to your values as a human, right? So a personal story, I remember, you know, we fight spammers every single day. And now we're fighting spammer gangs. You can tell these are like gangs. It's a group of people because they come with hundreds of domains that they bought. And it's just like the most sophisticated attacks you can ever imagine. I never talk about these things publicly, but it's a big part of our operations on the day-to-day. And then one day, I don't know if you saw the news, but there was like a huge flood in the south of Brazil, close to my city, the city I was born at. And I'm like super sad that this is happening. I'm watching on the news. My friends are talking about it all the time. And then one day I go to Recent and there's like a phishing email targeting like donations for that flood.
That's personal.
And I saw that. I was like, wow, this is so low. Like how come like a human being is trying to take advantage of folks that are like donating money to like a flood? That was like so bad. And we see stuff like that all the time. That was like, wow, like we just need to improve. So you put all those things in place, the sum of all those little things that start happening, like realizing that DX is much more than what it seems, the things we're seeing on the day-to-day and what we see for the future with those roles. We just needed to like hire more folks and build a more sophisticated system. So it felt right to make that investment.
You are one of those founders that is very hands-on. You're an engineer yourself. And I mean, you still code, right, today. Is it hard for you to delegate?
Yeah, it is for sure. In so many ways, I feel like it's still important for me to be on the PRs and I'm not necessarily reviewing everything that comes in. My CTO does that. But I try to keep a pulse because as the person who's deciding where the product is going, it's important for me to understand like what are the engineers building, because maybe that one thing that this one engineer built might influence this other thing that like a bigger strategy. So for me, it's super helpful as a product person now thinking from that angle to understand what's going on in engineering. And there's just something about like showing the team what's possible and where my mind is at. I feel like it just translates like what are your priorities very quickly when they see a PR with your code changes, right? I try to be as hands-on as possible. It gets harder every single time. And that's not only within engineering, like within support, we don't have a weekend coverage for support. So who does support over the weekend? Me, you know, just this weekend, we were celebrating like, oh, okay, inbox zero Friday afternoon. And the team even tweeted about it. And then Saturday, I was super busy. I couldn't do support. And then Sunday, I'm like, okay, let's do it. And then I open and it's like 200 plus tickets because we're just getting so many users, a lot of people from Lovable and V0 and Bolt, who are different types of users that don't really know how to troubleshoot. So we're just learning a lot. And, you know, so I tried to be in touch with support so they know like that I'm there for them as well. And I feel like that really translates the culture that, you know, we want to be hands-on and there's no room for someone that just sits and, you know, demands like, oh, a Jira ticket creator, like they don't have space at Recent, but a maker, they do.
So interesting. So in my previous episode with Jeff, we talked about perfectionism. And I think that you guys are also similar in that sense, because if you kind of think about your product and your website and everything across the board, it strives to be at a certain level of excellence, you know? And one of the things that we discussed, and I also kind of like looked at one of the pages in the handbook about providing feedback. With that level of perfectionism, with that level of like striving for a certain level of excellence, how do you not become toxic? Like, how do you give people space to make mistakes, to be imperfect, to learn?
That's a very fine line. So I'm glad you brought it up. Like, there are many times that I felt like, oh, wow, like, maybe like if I continue down that path, that's what's going to show up. But what I've realized, like, there's always this battle when we're building something of like, if you want high quality, that means it's going to take a lot of time. Or if you want something that's going to be very fast, okay, we're going to ship next week or today or tomorrow, then the quality bar is going to be low. There's always that tension, right? Yeah. Between those two things. And when you're trying to, like, if you think from that perfectionist brain, then what you're going to do is like, yeah, high quality, and it's going to take time. The speed is going to be low. I truly believe you can do both if you look at scope. And we cut scope relentlessly. Like, we are always like, okay, we're not going to ship something we're not proud of. We're not going to ship crap, but we need to ship fast. So how do you do that? Like, oh, we thought about these four use cases. We're just going to focus on three of them, or two of them, or one of them if necessary. So I push the team a lot about that. And culture wise, what I try to like steal on the team is that mentality of like doing something that is so good, but so good that inspires others, right? So they have to go to the recent website and be like, wow, I want to copy this. And when they do copy, we want to be proud that they copy, not like, oh, bitter about it, you know? So I would like ask the team, the designers, the engineers, like, okay, who do you admire? And then they would say like, oh, Guillermo from Vercel or Patrick from Stripe, right? Okay, we're going to release this feature and we're going to tweet about it. How can we tweet this in a way that when Patrick sees it, they will be copying that link, going to the Stripe Slack and sharing with the Stripe team like, hey guys, this is awesome. We should copy this. We should be inspired by this. So that puts the bar like very high, because now you're like, okay, how do I impress my hero? And if you're shooting for that, you're probably going to be able to build something that's better than what you're thinking. So yeah, we try to be an inspiring brand, and doing work that's okay is easy. Doing work that inspires, it's a huge challenge.
It sounds like a lot of pressure, but even listening to you talking about it, I get excited. I'm like, yeah, because I understand what you're talking about, because when I was on your website, that's the feeling I got. And we talk a lot about being proactive rather than being reactive, right? And this is something that you bring up, right? Thinking about your ICP or your heroes or whatever, and thinking about how would that exact person see this message, right? Like, how would they think about our product or our offering? Was it always like that for you? Like, do you always have that customer experience kind of like focus?
I think this doesn't have to be a rule for everyone listening and thinking about building their own thing. But for us, it was, because we were entering a super crowded market. Like, email APIs exist for 10 plus years, 15 plus years. The players in that industry, they're super established. Like, they have their piece of the pie and they take advantage of that. So for us, coming into this market, like, how are we going to be different? We're not AI. We're not like innovating like crazy. Of course, we have like some innovations here and there, but it's not like we are changing the way the world operates. So we just got to come with like a very fresh brand, a 10X product, which is super hard. And so everything about it, like, okay, we have to build in public because none of our competitors do. The color palette, like, it's all white and blue, or white and red, white and yellow. We're going to go dark mode first. And it has to be that way because we need to stand out. The Rubik's Cube you see rotating on the page, like you're not going to get that on our competitors' websites. But this is what you're getting here, you know? So from day one, everything had to be like a notch up. And I remember joining YC and thinking like, okay, we're going to be the best company in this batch, not the 10th or the 15th, like the best one. So even like how we bought our domains, like people were buying like, oh, something.io, something.ai or something. And we're like, no, we're getting a super strong .com domain, a dictionary word if we can, and something that's related to our business. It just needs to be something cool. And so even for like something that could seem as small as a domain, for us was super important. So I didn't want to get like a getsend.com or getresend.com. No, it's resend.com. So the Twitter handle, we had Resend Labs in the beginning. I hated that with like all my heart.
Yeah.
But because we couldn't get Resend. And yeah. I was fighting like we need just Resend, you know? Now we are fighting that battle with YouTube. It's hard to get the YouTube handle. But like all of these things are part of that. You know, if you take that one thing seriously, then everything else you take seriously, right? As a brand. So that was really important to us.
Let's talk about YC for a second. Mm-hmm. So before you even launched, you had something like thousands of signups on your waitlist. Mm-hmm. How did you manage that?
This was like years in the making. I remember I created my Twitter account back in 2009, and with every single open source project I had, I tried to be as public as I could. And I remember when I was still living in Brazil back in 2014 or something, I started to tweet in English instead of Portuguese. And all my friends, they were like, wow, that guy is such a snob, like who he thinks he is or something like that. But I was already having that mentality of like, I'm building for the international market. I'm not building for a specific country or geo. I'm building for everyone. So if you have that mentality, like from the start, then the way you operate changes. So it doesn't matter where you live. What matters is like who you're serving. So I remember seeing a lot of companies on YC that were like very geocentric or center around like specific language. And we're like, no. We're not going to do that at all. This is an international company serving international market. We can be anywhere and that's great. It doesn't matter where the team is located, but we're focusing on a specific place. So yeah, that was a big part of like just building that audience early on, building that founder brand. Even today, every morning I wake up and I feel like it's a duty for myself to like continue to evolve that founder brand, because a lot of prospects are going to come through that, not through the company's brand. And we have to like have those two brands like at the best capacity they can. And just having like a fresh, like the wait list, like I remember we already had the Rubik's Cube, for example, like from the start. And because we already wanted like
you needed the moat.
We needed a moat. And you got to earn it. You can have a strategy or an idea, but like you got to earn it. And for us, if we wanted to have the quality moat, we would have to put the work in.
And your co-founding team, your friends, right? You were friends before
you
started business together.
That's right. So I used to work with Boo, who's my CTO at WorkOS, and my CEO, we used to work at Liferay. And those are two people that I knew Johnny, my CEO, for a long time. But Boo, I've worked with him for like a year and a half. So I see like co-founder stories, people that went to school together, they know each other for 15 years and so on. That was not my case with Boo. But he had something that was so special. He was able to be vulnerable and not be afraid of being vulnerable. So he would come and say like, yeah, I'm not feeling great today. So I didn't like in a daily stand-up, right? Yeah, I wasn't productive. But it was a day. I kept watching YouTube videos. But you know what? Like tomorrow, I'm going to make it up for it. And I feel much better now. And that's it. And I just felt like something really powerful, like zero ego, like absolutely no ego. And that was really important to me. Like, if I'm starting a company with someone, we gotta have that, because I've seen ego destroying cultures elsewhere. So that was the only thing, like, internally that I could feel like, okay, this is a great co-founder. And as time went by, there were many moments that I was like, wow, I'm glad he exists in my life. You know, YC pushes a lot for you to have a co-founder. And I never really got it. There was one day that I was traveling to New York, and this was like a big event, and I was going to meet like some executives in the stock exchange. I'm like, wow, this is big, right? So I traveled there, and then as I'm entering the building, I remember this, it was so vivid. I can feel it in my bones because it's so traumatic. I get a call, and then it's our alerting system saying like, oh, there's a downtime. And I'm like, wow, there's a downtime. But I have a meeting with like the Warner Brothers executive in like 10 minutes. What am I going to do? And I'm like, I cannot deal with that, because I need to be that,
headspace.
You know, I need to project confidence to that guy and tell them like, yeah, recent is the best thing that exists in the world, you know, but at this very moment, yeah, like there's like a situation happening. So I remember just telling people like, boo, I cannot deal with this. Good luck, man. And I'm here for you and I trust you. And then I just put my phone in airplane mode and went in. And that's the level of trust you need to have, you know. That's the beauty of having a co-founder, because you can have those moments. And yeah, like it's great. And yeah, I'm super thankful that they are in my life, because it would be very, very hard to do this without them.
Do you feel like your skill set complement each other?
It does. Even though I'm technical and I'm pushing code every day, now my code is much more superficial than it used to be, right? Even though I can help with operations and stuff like that, that's not the place I really want to spend my time, you know? I'm really good at product, I'm good at marketing, and that's my genius zone. And they have their own genius zones, and Boo is like super ultra technical, super low key. You don't even see a photo of him online. Like, he has an avatar, like you can't see his face. So it's a different personality. And Johnny is like so focused on culture and so focused on like making everything internally work well and function well. I don't want to deal with payroll. I don't want to deal with like those things. So I think it really helps to have those skills. And we could all do a little bit of each other's work, and we do step in into each other's areas many times to cover and to help think through the problems and stuff. But yeah, having a corner of your own, I think it's important.
It's so interesting how you talk about the genius zone. So it's not just about things that you're good at, right? There are things that you're better than anyone else at. And even if you're technical, your strength is not there, you know, it's something else. And it's so important to be so kind of like aware of your genius zone. And for me personally, for example, like recording videos or like posting something quick is much easier than for my engineers, you know? And because it comes so easy, sometimes it's really easy to dismiss it. Have you ever felt that okay, it's so mm-hmm. easy, like yeah. what's so, you know, cool about it? Or you're hyper aware of like your genius zone?
It takes time. It takes a lot of self-awareness and self-reflection to even be able to identify what you're good at. Because I think when you're starting a startup, like there's just so many things you can do. And in the beginning, for example, I could have spent a lot of energy in engineering, but we needed someone to be thinking about distribution. And we wouldn't have those 20,000 people on the waitlist if there wasn't someone thinking about that. So at all times, we had to be like aware that, and those things change as well. So as time goes by, you realize like, oh, internally, this is the place where I get the most energy from. So for example, fighting the abusers, I don't get energy from that at all. Like, I'm drained, I feel bad about it, and I feel stressed. Because you're always like in fighting mode. It's always like a game of mouse and cat, where they never stop. And you also cannot stop. You have to, like, they are innovating and we have to innovate as well to block them. I hate that game. I don't want to be in that game. But the game of like building something that people enjoy, they're inspired by, that raises the bar for the whole industry, not only for ourselves. I love that game. So that's a game that I get energy from. So like, I think that's a good way of framing. Like, I think you find your genius zone when you understand like, where's the place that I get energy from? Of course, it's hard too, because I love coding, and coding is also a escape hatch for me. If things are, you know, like complicated on the sales side, which is not my favorite area, I go to coding so easily. I'm like, oh yeah, there's this thing. It's so important. We need to build it. This feature is so important. And then I go there and I have to stop myself too, because then you get into these comfort zones. That's not really like where the company needs you to be. So it's so tricky. Like every single day I'm bouncing between those things.
So we work with about 40 developer tool startups each year. So this is something that I see time and time again, right? Like, oh, we need to perfect this. We need to make this product perfect. We cannot launch, you know? And it continues for a long time because it's such a safe space. Yeah. You know, when you're not visible, you're not vulnerable. Yes. And you can just kind of like creating tasks for yourself that are super important to do. Shifting that mindset is actually painful. Like, it's not an easy thing to do because it forces you to do things that you're not comfortable with. Do you have kind of like a recipe for how you make yourself do things that feel scary?
I do. I try to seek the truth as much as possible. And when you're in that mindset, for example, we launch a new AI product for you to create email templates. And I remember like, oh, I have like some idea of how this would look like, some confidence, but I don't want to put like everything in that one basket. Like, I want the market to tell me, is this a product or is this a feature, for example? So almost like detaching yourself from your beliefs and just trying to seek the truth. I will let the market tell me if this is good or bad. And I'll try to cut scope as much as possible. I will have like a paid plan from day one, because that's a way for me to get to the truth and not just like be hiding behind like GitHub stars. That's so easy when you're building a developer tools. Like, oh, I have these many GitHub stars, or I have these many people on your wait list. It doesn't matter. Like, in the end, it's how many people are paying. And even in that sales mindset, I remember in the beginning, for me, it was always about like, oh, how do I move this one prospect, this one person from this stage of the pipeline to the next stage? And now the way I feel it is like, how do I get to the no faster? And when I try to get to the no, it's hard because I don't want to get the no, of course, right? Rejection, it's hard for every human being. For me personally, I'm a people pleaser. It's hard. Like, and I have to like fight that nature to be like, no, I want to get to know as fast as possible, because then I can move to the next and to the next. And finding like, okay, what's really blocking them? If I push for the no, then they will tell me like, yeah, we cannot close because you guys don't have this, or because you don't have like HIPAA compliant, or like whatever the reason is, it doesn't matter. But I need to find that objection as fast as possible, because there are many other companies that should be pursuing or should be thinking about.
That's so interesting, because like, if you think about a deal that is closed and taking a while to close, it already feels like it's not a fit, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, okay, there is something that I don't quite understand yet. It's really hard to close. I'm sure there is something, right? Like a concern on their side, or something blocking the decision, or whatever it is. And you try so hard to make the ends meet. But in reality, I think you're right. Like, you want to hear the no faster, because you're wasting all this time and all this energy just like down the drain. This is not a deal that's going to happen unless, you know, there are different scenarios, but, you know, and maybe, you know, the answer is somewhere else, like not in this deal.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And in the moment, it's hard to say no to an opportunity, you know? So it takes courage in a way. And like, looking at your bio in general, I feel like you've taken a few kind of like leaps of faith. Mm. If you think about it, like moving to the US, you know, or going from the VP of developer experience at WorkOS to starting your own company or building in the space that's already overcrowded. You know, there are so many kind of bets that you've taken. And you do it with such confidence, but I'm sure it's not always easy. Yeah. I'm sure, like, you know, in your mind, you are, you know, weighing the options and it takes you a while to make a decision. How do you go about those difficult decisions? Like, do you have a strategy as how you approach those? Or it's something that you just do on a whim and figure it out?
I think it's more like a mindset. I remember watching this video from Steve Jobs and he was saying like how like everything in the world was built by someone, right?
Yes.
You know, that one, it's a classic.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if you push in one place, something pulls up on the other place, right? And I try to look at the world from that angle, like, okay, this desk, it was built by someone. Is this like the best desk that could exist? I don't know. Maybe it should be a different shape. It should be a different size or different material that no one has ever done before. And that's something that when I think about my daughter, I want to instill that in her. Like, everything you see around you, it can be shaped and influenced by you. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean you're going to succeed. I had a lot of projects that failed for sure. Like a graveyard of side projects that I can look back. But I try to approach it from that angle. And as you progress in your career, as you get like the early wins, that gives you more confidence to then take that bigger step. So, just like my experience at WorkOS completely influenced my decision to start Resend because I saw that business from the inside and I saw how something as boring as SSO and single sign-on, SAML, like no one wants to deal with that. You know, when there's something that no one wants to deal with, that's actually a great business idea, you know? And turns out no one wants to deal with email. They all hate it. They all like don't want to think about spam folders and the priority inbox, like all that kind of stuff. So let me go into a space like that. That business was so sticky. Like once you integrate with single sign-on or any authentication provider, you don't want to move to another one. If it's working, you just keep it. Same for email. Like you integrate with email, you're like, just set it and forget it, right? So those things, like as you see them for yourself and you see those machines like working, you get more confidence. So I try to approach from that angle and but it's hard. It doesn't mean it's easy. And you gotta always find like, okay, what's different about it? Even if it like for us, like a big insight was like, let's focus on brand. And people are like, but brand alone doesn't, you know, solve all the problems. We're like, we know. But we're gonna layer that with other things over time. And we had like React as an angle. And then that was a way for us to get into that ecosystem and focus on JavaScript, on the Node ecosystem. So you keep layering those bets and getting confidence over time.
So throughout your biography, open source has been a huge part of your philosophy of everything that you do. And I mean, React Mail was, you just posted the other day that it was like the top mail agent, right? So when you think about open source, and obviously for Resend too, I mean, in your conversation with the investors, you know, how your stance on open source impacted the deals that you were discussing, and in general, how important it is for you to have, you know, open source offering for your customers.
I feel like open source is more than a distribution channel or distribution strategy, and it's more like a lifestyle. So that's how I try to approach it. Like, how do I open source my thinking as a founder? Okay, that's through Twitter. How do I open source my company? That's through the handbook. So I try to apply that lifestyle everywhere. That's why we're here, you know, sharing the strategies and what worked and what didn't. And for us, it was all about like, okay, this company, this idea, it doesn't seem like an open source project necessarily, but we need an open source component. So I knew from the get-go that Resend will never be open source. That's not a plan. We're not going to do it. If you're waiting for it, don't count on it. But we are going to bet heavily on open source, especially in the beginning. So I remember writing this master plan inspired by the Tesla one. And there was just only like three bullet points. The first one was build an open source project. Second one was establish ourselves as email experts. And then the third one was launch a SaaS around that open source project. And that's how we layered. Like we were building recent and we already like, okay, this seems like a good idea and so on. And then it came to a point where like, okay, we're maybe getting close to launching. How we're going to launch it? Out of nowhere without even thinking about it? No. Let's do an open source project first. And then we launched recent later. So that's what we did, like launching the open source project in December. And then in January, we announced recent. And that played really well, just thinking about the story that we're going to tell. Like, hey, we're giving first. So it's the whole jab, jab, right hook strategy. You know, like you give first, you give, and then you ask. So that was our plan. Like, let's give. And then, you know, when people are already adopting React to send their emails, now they need a platform to send it. Oh, here's the platform. And this is the place we're going to make money. This is the place we're going to charge. Mm-hmm. Like innovating how email templates are built. We're going to invest on that in terms of R&D, but we're not going to charge for that. This is where we feel like it's the best place to charge. And that turned out to be like a good strategy. So I highly recommend folks to have some component, even if it's not your whole thing, right? Like call.com, PostHog, it's their thing. Like you can actually run their Supabase. Yeah. You can run their whole product. You don't necessarily need to go down that far. You can, and it's amazing if you can do it, but there's some products that you can't. And in our case, that was the case because of all the security portion. So then let's make this component up.
Do you have a certain strategy as to how to kind of convert those potential paying customers from the open source base?
Some of that is counterintuitive because I remember I wrote those docs myself. Like, here's React email. You can actually use SendGrid and use Mailgun and use Postmark and use SES, like all of our competitors. Here's how you use it with them. And I was very intentional about like, no, we're going to promote our competitors here and we're going to show recent right next to them. The only difference, like it's like a little banner. Hey, recent was created by the same creators of React email. And that shows a level of confidence of like this product is built for you. If you want to use it with something else, that's fine. I actually love it when people use with something else because that means maybe one day they can be recent users. But we don't try it as hard to be like, oh, let's look at everyone that started a repo. Let's get their email addresses. Let's put them in the funnel. I try to be as organic as possible in that world. But what I try to do is every single day post about recent and every single day be top of mind. Because one day when people do need a new email provider or finally need to add email functionality to their apps, recent needs to be the first thing that pops on their mind. So I try not to convince them at all times, but I try to be in front of them at all times. So the moment they need something, they know the answer is already there on their subconsciously.
Do you ever struggle with what you want to write about?
Oh, yeah. Every single day.
I thought you're just overflowing with ideas.
Not at all. And I tried to create some like systems for myself. Like, yeah, I have this Notion page like, okay, ideas for tweets. And then it's like, oh, tell a story about the past. Or try to create a listicle with like things that you think are important. Or like, I have like all these methods to help me think about what to write. Because I wake up, I'm not excited to write about anything. I have so many problems I need to look at. When I wake up here in SF, my whole team is already working at full speed. And I know I have like 1 hour to tweet before the day starts. So I'm like, okay, I just got to get this out of the way and then continue with my day. So yeah, I definitely don't overflow with ideas.
So your team is distributed. And there is this whole debate. Our team is distributed too. And we try to make it work, right? Mm-hmm. And we're quite spread, like from Japan to San Francisco,
wow.
Like the whole thing.
That's crazy.
And sometimes it's super effective because they can work on something during the day. Somebody in Portugal picks it up, work on that during the day. And then, you know, here we work with clients. So easy. How do you make it work? And do you believe that you need to be in the same office, heads down, to be productive?
I'm not like super, I don't know, religious about like remote, as many people that are like, oh, this is the only way to make it work. Or you see that with like so many topics, right? Like some people that are like, oh, VC is evil.
Yeah.
And bootstrapping a business is the only way to go. I bootstrapped a business before. I think it's beautiful. It's amazing. That's what I did with Dracula. That was so cool. But, you know, there's certain types of business that needs to be VC backed, and it's fine. So for me, that's the same for being remote or not. If all your network is in a specific city already, you grew up here, like, you know, like you went to school here, like, yeah, just make it here. If your whole, like all your friends, the people you met online are all distributed, maybe that makes sense. So for me, it was just more about like, what fits this company, this group of people? And the remote thing was the way to go. And we get the same benefits as you were describing. Like we have a person in South Africa, you know, like how amazing is that, that we can serve that time zone, and we might be sleeping and that person can help with support and or deal with an incident. So yeah, there's just so many advantages, like being able to explore the whole talent that exists in the world versus just concentrated in a specific city. And I've seen many people like change their minds along the way. Like many of my friends from YC that were like fully remote, and that's why we connected in the first place. Now they are buying offices and they're like having everyone move to San Francisco or somewhere else. I think both can work. So I think it's more about like, what are you committing? The hybrid one is the most challenging one. So I think it's better if you go all in on remote or all in on in person, because the hybrid one is like the thing that disconnects most people. Like, oh, you have some people in a room, they're all like watching on TV, and then you have like some people at their homes. This is tricky, but you know, I don't even know like for the future of Reason, like what's going to be like when we have 500 people or 100 people or 50, like maybe it will change. But right now, remote serves us well. We, of course, there's so many challenges, you know, everyone knows it's super hard. But if you're intentional about it, like the handbook and those things, they help.
Do you feel like it's still important for you personally to be in SF?
Yeah, at least in the beginning, I felt like my mentality was, if I was a board member of this company and the founder came to me and said, hey, we're going to build a remote company, I'll be like, yeah, go for it. It's fine. It works. But you as a founder, you got to be here at least in the beginning. So that's how I think about it. Like, okay, I gave myself like 3 years that I had to be here. And I had like all these crazy stories. My car was stolen here. Like, just like a mess. Like there's so much stuff that happened when I was here, but I was like very committed. Now I'm more open. Like now I'm traveling everywhere. I try to be with the team a lot. And I felt like investing on the team is sometimes more important than trying to be in a specific place and investing my time on trying to close like a specific company. Or so I'm way more conscious about like how I spend my time. And yeah. And then the city doesn't matter. Like what matters is where my team is. And if I have to travel to see them in person, I do. Or if I have to travel to be on the same time zone as they are, I will do that. Whatever it takes to keep them motivated and always trying to raise the bar for them.
So this is second to last question.
Uh-huh.
And it's about events.
Nice.
Because you're everywhere. Honestly, like any event that I can think of, you're there. Probably with a booth too. How do you make those decisions?
Yeah.
Do you have specific goals in mind?
Yeah.
Is it ever difficult?
This is an experiment for us. I personally been to a lot of events myself. So I know what it takes to be at an event and the mental toll of being at an event and how tiring it is. So there's so many problems and challenges in terms of like going to events. But now I'm on this seat of like, okay, how do we position the brand in places that are not just online? There's an undeniable component of like being in person and how that affects how you perceive a brand. So we're just trying now. So it's hard to tell, like we don't have like a goal of like scanning these many badges at the booth and that's how we're going to justify But we try to keep it fresh and like have like different ideas. So we did like the hot sauce at the Super Bass event, and that's where we met. And like those things, they help you keep on your toes, and it helps you expand the umbrella of what your brand looks like as well. That's why I love doing launch weeks, because you can also stretch the brand a little bit further than you think.
And I think you and Irina met at LaraConf, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, Irina, yeah.
So it's like you have quite a breadth of different events, and you are very present, and you try to be creative, which is cool. And I know it takes a lot of energy, and it gets tiring.
It can be a huge distraction. Huge. You're putting so much money if you're doing a booth. Like we did the emails that changed the world.
Yeah, I loved it.
That was cool, right? But that takes like a lot of brainstorming and going to the store and finding the piece of wood and like that kind of stuff like that. You know, it's so much better you record a video and put it on YouTube. You're going to reach more people. Like even 1,000 views, it's better than like the 200 people that are at the event and that are not going to all interact with your booth. So it's super difficult, but there's just something that you can't really put a price tag on. Like the right people at the right place that are looking, they're like, oh, okay, like one speaker that's there that's now seeing your booth.
And I mean, Super Bass Select, mm-hmm. I love the event. I was like squeaking the whole time. Yeah. It was awesome because it was so small. I think like the feeling there was just great overall.
And you want to position your brand as peers, right? So for us, it's like, okay, Super Bass is insane now, right? Like Super, they just raised another round. We want to be perceived at the same level of Super Bass, even though we're not remotely close to how much money they raise or all other metrics or number of users or whatever, right? But that's the same for other events. Like we got to be like, we want to be perceived as equals, even though you're not there yet.
I mean, and now with Vibe Coding, and you're also serving the same audience that gave them that huge boost, right?
Yes.
With Bolt and all of the tools that people use for Vibe Coding.
For sure.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
So my final question, and this is my favorite question, I call it warm fuzzies. Mm. And the question goes like this. What makes you feel great about what you're doing today?
It's hard because I feel like I'm a founder, I'm a dad, I'm a husband, because like you're always trying to balance everything and trying to be good at all these things, and it's so damn hard, right? So I don't feel great most of the time. I actually feel like I'm either dropping the ball in one place or another. But now as the team is growing, like I wasn't expecting to be as fulfilled as I am in terms of like building a company and building this place that people are excited about. Yeah, I saw a tweet from our team member from South Africa, and he's such a hard person to read. Like you wouldn't really get like, okay, all his reactions and how he's feeling, he's more closed naturally. So then he was just tweeting about like how he's having like the greatest time and waking up super excited, and he never felt that way at work. So I saw that and I was like, wow. And we are providing that space for him. Like we are building this out of nowhere. So you think about a company, you think about a brand, that's such an artificial concept. It's just a group of people that are hanging there, that are like hanging out there and trying to build something cool, right? So I get a lot of, like energy, and I'm super happy when I see that, wow, like, yeah, if it wasn't for us, like this place wouldn't exist. I'm sure they will have amazing jobs. They're probably making even more money than they are here, but because they're so amazing, but yeah. I just love that.
Finally, I want to provide you space to talk about Resend. So if you were to encourage our listeners to try it, how can they find it? Where should they start?
Yeah, definitely go to resend.com and check out what we have over there. It's an email API that helps you, you know, get to humans and not the spam folder. That's what we are all about. And we can help with like transactional emails, like the ones you send with reset passwords and welcome emails, but also your marketing ones. So if you're sending a campaign, if you're sending like product update every month, Resend can help with that. And yeah, we're just trying to build something cool that's fresh, that's unique, and raise the bar for the whole industry.
Thank you so much, Zeno. This was amazing. And so many insights, so much inspiration. I really hope that all the energy that you produce for the world gets reciprocated, and you guys just, you know, grow and make more people happy by employing them.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs. We at Evil Martians transform growth stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open source products. If your developer tool needs help with product design, development, or SRE, visit evilmartians.com/devtools. See you in the next.